But if you see anyone in the neighborhood who looks like any of the pictures I showed you, I'll call you first. She looked at his name tag. Officer Abramowitz. He smiled. You do that, he said. That night, in bed, hit me, as though it were not lovemaking but some nightmare blackjack game. No. She was on top of him, which made him easy to reach. The sound of her palm hitting the side of his face was like the report of an air gun. Chad hit her back without thinking. She began to cry. Her eyes shone. He did her. Outside, someone's car alarm went off. They went to Vermont in January. They went on the train. It was lovely, like a picture postcard. They saw a house they both liked about 20 miles outside of Montpelier. It was only the third one they'd looked at. The real estate agent's name was Jody Enders. She was very pleasant, but she kept looking at Nora's right eye. Finally, Nora said with an embarrassed little laugh, I slipped on a patch of ice while I was getting into a taxi. You should have seen me last week. I looked like a spouse abuse ad. I can hardly see it, Jody Enders said. Then shyly, you're very pretty. Chad put his arm around Nora's shoulders. I think so, too. What do you do for a living, Mr. Callahan? I'm a writer, he said. They made a down payment on the house. On the loan agreement, Nora checked owner financed. In the details box, she wrote simply, savings. One day in February, while they were packing for the move, Chad went into Manhattan to see a movie at the Angelica and have dinner with his agent. Officer Abramowitz had given Nora his card. She called him. He came over, and they fucked in the mostly empty bedroom. It was good, but it would have been better if she could have persuaded him to hit her. She asked, but he wouldn't. What kind of crazy lady are you? He asked in that voice that people use when they mean, I'm joking, but not really. I don't know, Nora said. I'm still finding out. We live and learn, Officer Abramowitz, don't we? They were scheduled to make the move to Vermont on February 29th. The day before, the telephone rang. It was Mrs. Granger, Pastor Emeritus Winston's housekeeper. As soon as Nora registered the woman's hushed tone, she knew why she had called, and her first thought was, "What did you do with the tape, you bastard?" The obituary will say kidney failure, Mrs. Granger said in her hushed, someone's dead voice. But I was in his bathroom. The medicine bottles were all out, and too many of the pills were gone. I think he committed suicide. Probably not, Nora said. She spoke in her calmest, surest, most nursely manner. What's more likely is that he became confused about how many he'd taken. He may have even had another stroke, a small one. Do you really think so? Oh, yes, Nora said, and had to restrain herself from asking if Mrs. Granger had seen a new video camera around anywhere. Hooked up to Winnie's TV, most likely. It would be insane to ask such a question. She almost did, anyway. That night, in bed, their last Brooklyn night. You need to stop worrying, Chad said. If someone finds that tape, they probably won't look at it. And if they do, the chance they'd connect it with you is so small as to be infinitesimal. Besides, the kid's probably forgotten it by now. The mother, too. The mother was there when a crazy lady assaulted her son and then ran away, Nora said. She'll never forget it. All right, he said in an equable tone that made her want to hike her knee straight into his balls. Maybe I ought to go over and help Mrs. Granger neaten the place up. He looked at her as if she were mad, then rolled away from her. Don't do that, she said. Come on, Chad. No, he said. What do you mean, no? Why? Because I know what you think of when we do it. She hit him. It was a pretty good thump on the back of the neck. He turned over and raised a fist. Don't do that, Nora. Go on, she said. You know you want to. He almost did. She saw the twitch. Then he lowered his hand and unrolled the fingers. No more. She said nothing but thought, that's what you think. Chad finished living with the animals in July and sent the manuscript to the agent. Emails and phone calls followed. Chad said Ringling seemed enthusiastic. If so, Nora thought he must have saved most of that enthusiasm for the phone calls. What she saw in the emails was cautious optimism at best. In August, at Ringling's request, Chad did some rewriting. He was quiet about this part of the work, a sign that it wasn't going particularly well. But he stuck to it. Nora hardly noticed. She was absorbed in her garden. In September, Chad insisted on going to New York and pacing Ringling's office while the man made phone calls to the 7 publishers to whom the manuscript had gone, hoping some of them would express an interest in meeting with the author. Nora thought about visiting a bar in Montpelier and picking someone up. They could go to a Motel 6, and didn't. It seemed like too much work for too little gain. She worked in her garden instead. It was just as well. Chad flew back that evening instead of spending the night in New York as he had planned. He was drunk. He also professed to be happy. They had a handshake deal. He named a publisher she had never heard of. How much? She asked. That doesn't really matter, babe. Doesn't came out doesn't, and he only called her babe when he was drunk. They really love the book, and that's what matters. Matters. She realized that when Chad was drunk, he sounded quite a bit like Winnie in the first months after his stroke. How much?
$40,000.
She laughed. I probably made that much before I got from the bench to the playground. I figured it out the first time we watched. She didn't see the blow coming and didn't really feel it hit. There was a kind of big click in her head. That was all. Then she was lying on the kitchen floor, breathing through her mouth. She had to breathe through her mouth. He had broken her nose.
You bitch,
he said, starting to cry. Nora sat up. The kitchen seemed to make a large drunken circle around her before steadying. Blood pattered down on the linoleum. She was amazed, in pain, exhilarated, full of shame and hilarity.
That's right, blame me, she said.
Her voice was foggy, hooting.
Blame me and then cry your stupid little eyes out.
He cocked his head as if he hadn't heard her or couldn't believe what he'd heard, then made a fist and drew it back. She raised her face, her now crooked nose leading the way. There was a beard of blood on her chin.
Go on, she said. It's the only thing you're halfway good at. How many men have you slept with since that day? Tell me.
Slept with none, fucked a dozen. A lie, actually. There had only been the cop and an electrician who'd come one day while Chad was in town.
Lay on, Macduff.
Instead of laying on, Macduff opened his fist and let his hand drop to his side.
The book would have been all right if not for you. I'm going to leave you and write another one, a better one.
Pigs will whistle.
You wait,
he said, as tearfully childish as a little boy who has just lost in a playground scuffle.
You just wait and see.
You're drunk. Go to bed.
You poison bitch.
Having delivered himself of this, he shuffled off to bed, walking with his head down. He even walked like Winnie after his stroke. Nora thought about going to urgent care for her nose, but was too tired to think of a story that would have just the right touch of veracity. In her heart, her nursely heart, she knew there was no such story. They would see through her no matter how good her story was. ER personnel always did. She stuffed cotton up her nose and took 2 Tylenol with codeine. Then she went outside and weeded her garden until it was too dark to see. He left her. He went back to New York. Sometimes he emailed her, and sometimes she emailed him back. He didn't ask for his half of the remaining money, which was good. She wouldn't have given it to him. She had worked for that money and was still working for it, feeding it into the bank little by little, paying off the house. He said in his emails that he was subbing again, writing on the weekends. She believed him about the subbing, but not the writing. His emails had a strengthless, washed-out feeling that suggested there might not be much left when it came to writing. She'd always thought he was pretty much of a one-book man anyway. She took care of the divorce herself. She found everything she needed on the internet. There were papers she needed him to sign, and he signed them. They came back with no note attached. The following summer, a good one. She was working full-time at the local hospital, and her garden was an absolute riot. She was browsing in a used bookstore one day and came across a volume she had seen in Winnie's study, The Basis of Morality. It was a pretty beat-up copy, and she was able to take it home for $2 plus tax. It took her the rest of the summer and most of the fall to read it cover to cover. In the end, she was disappointed. There was little or nothing in it she did not already know.
For Jim Sprouse. I think that most people tend to meditate more on what comes next as they get older, and since I'm now in my late 60s, I qualify in that regard. Several of my short stories and at least one novel, Revival, have approached this question. I can't say have dealt with it, because that implies some conclusion, and none of us can really draw one, can we? Nobody has sent back any cell phone video from the land of death. This faith, of course, and a veritable deluge of heaven is real books, but faith is, by its very definition, belief without proof. When you boil it down, there are only two choices. Either there's something, or there's nothing. If it's the latter, case closed. If it's the former, there are myriad possibilities, with heaven, hell, purgatory, and reincarnation being the most popular on the afterlife hit parade. Or maybe you get what you always believed you would get. Maybe the brain is equipped with a deeply embedded exit program that starts running just as everything else is running down, and we're getting ready to catch that final train. To me, reports of near-death experiences tend to support this idea. What I'd like, I think, is a chance to go through it all again as a kind of immersive movie, so I could relish the good times and good calls, like marrying my wife and our decision to have that third child. Of course, I'd also have to rue the bad calls. I've made my share. But who wouldn't like to re-experience that first good kiss, or have a chance to relax and really enjoy the wedding ceremony that went by in such a nervous blur? This story isn't about such a rerun, not exactly, but musing about the possibility led me to write about one man's afterlife. The reason fantasy fiction remains such a vital and necessary genre is that it lets us talk about such things in a way realistic fiction cannot.
Afterlife, read by Dylan Baker.
William Andrews, an investment banker with Goldman Sachs, dies on the afternoon of September 23, 2012. It is an expected death. His wife and adult children are at his bedside. That evening, when she finally allows herself some time alone, away from the steady stream of family and condolence visitors, Lynn Andrews calls her oldest friend who still lives in Milwaukee. It was Sally Freeman who introduced her to Bill, and if anyone deserves to know about the last 60 seconds of her 30-year marriage, it's Sally. He was out of it for most of the last week, the drugs, but conscious at the end. His eyes were open, and he saw me. He smiled. I took his hand and he squeezed it a little. I bent over and kissed his cheek. When I straightened up again, he was gone. She has been waiting for hours to say this, and with it said, she bursts into tears. Her assumption that the smile was for her is natural enough, but mistaken. As he is looking up at his wife and three grown children, they seem impossibly tall, creatures of angelic good health inhabiting a world he is now departing. Bill feels the pain he has lived with for the past 18 months leave his body. It pours out like slop from a bucket. So, he smiles. With the pain gone, there's little left. His body feels as light as a fluff of milkweed. His wife takes his hand, reaching down from her tall and healthy world. He has reserved a little bit of strength, which he now expends by squeezing her fingers. She bends down. She is going to kiss him. Before her lips can touch his skin, a hole appears in the center of his vision. It's not a black hole, but a white one. It spreads, obliterating the only world he's known since 1956, when he was born in the small Hemingford County Hospital in Nebraska. During the last year, Bill has read a great deal about the passage from life to death on his computer, always careful to obliterate the history so as not to upset Lynn, who is constantly and unrealistically upbeat. And while most of it struck him as bullshit, the so-called white light phenomenon seemed quite plausible. For one thing, it has been reported in all cultures. For another, it has a smidgen of scientific credibility. One theory he's read suggests the white light comes as a result of the sudden cessation of blood flow to the brain. Another, more elegant, posits that the brain is performing a final global scan in an effort to find an experience comparable to dying. Or it may just be a final firework. Whatever the cause, Bill Andrews is now experiencing it. The white light obliterates his family and the airy room from which the mortuary assistants will soon remove his sheeted, breathless body. In his researches, he became familiar with the acronym NDE, standing for Near-Death Experience. In many of these experiences, the white light becomes a tunnel, at the end of which stand beckoning family members who have already died, or friends, or angels, or Jesus, or some other beneficent deity. Bill expects no welcoming committee. What he expects is for the final firework to fade to the blackness of oblivion. But that doesn't happen. When the brilliance dims, he's not in heaven or hell. He's in a hallway. He supposes it could be purgatory. A hallway painted industrial green and floored in scuffed and dirty tile could very well be purgatory, but only if it went on forever. This one ends 20 feet down at a door with a sign on it reading, Isaac Harris, Manager. Bill stands where he is for a few moments, inventorying himself. He's wearing the pajamas he died in, at least he assumes he died. And he's barefoot. But there's no sign of the cancer that first tasted his body, then gobbled it down to nothing but skin and skeleton. He looks to be back at about 190, which was his fighting weight, slightly soft-bellied, granted, before the cancer struck. He feels his buttocks and the small of his back. The bed sores are gone. Nice. He takes a deep breath and exhales without coughing. Even nicer. He walks a little way down the hall. On his left is a fire extinguisher with a peculiar graffito above it. Better late than never. On his right is a bulletin board. On this a number of photographs have been pinned, the old-fashioned kind with decal edges. Above them is a hand-printed banner reading, Company Picnic, 1956. What fun we had! Bill examines the photographs, which show executives, secretaries, office personnel, and a gaggle of romping kids smeared with ice cream. There are guys tending a barbecue, one wearing the obligatory joke toque, guys and gals tossing horseshoes, guys and gals playing volleyball, guys and gals swimming in a lake. The guys are wearing bathing suits that look almost obscenely short and tight to his 21st century eye, but very few of them are carrying big guts. They have 50s physiques, Bill thinks. The gals are wearing those old-fashioned Esther Williams tank suits, the kind that make women look as if they have not buttocks, but only a smooth and cleftless swoop above the backs of their thighs. Hot dogs are being consumed, beer is being drunk, everybody appears to be having a whale of a good time. In one of the pictures, he sees Richie Blankmore's father handing Anne-Marie Winkler a toasted marshmallow. This is ridiculous, because Richie's dad was a truck driver and never went to a company picnic in his life. Anne-Marie was a girl he dated in college. In another photo, he sees Bobby Tisdale, a college classmate back in the early 70s. Bobby, who referred to himself as Tiz the Whiz, died of a heart attack while still in his 30s. He was probably on Earth in 1956, but would have been in kindergarten or the first grade, not drinking beer on the shore of Lake whatever. In this picture, the Whiz looks about 20, which would have been his age when Bill knew him. In a third picture, Eddie Scarpone's mom is baffing a volleyball. Eddie was Bill's best friend when the family moved from Nebraska to Paramus, New Jersey, and Gina Scarpone, once glimpsed sunning herself on the patio in filmy white panties and nothing else, was one of Bill's favorite fantasies when he was still on his masturbation learner's permit. The guy in the joke toque is Ronald Reagan. Bill looks closely, his nose almost pressing against the black and white photo, and there can be no doubt. The 40th President of the United States is flipping burgers at a company picnic. What company, though? And where exactly is Bill now? His euphoria at being whole again and pain-free is fading. What replaces it is a growing sense of dislocation and unease. Seeing these familiar people in the photographs doesn't make sense, and the fact that he doesn't know the majority of them offers marginal comfort at best. He looks behind him and sees stairs leading up to another door. Printed on this one in large red block letters is "Locked." That leaves only Mr. Isaac Harris's office. Bill walks down there, hesitates, and then knocks. "It's open!" Bill walks in. Beside a cluttered desk stands a fellow in baggy, high-waisted suit pants held up by suspenders. His brown hair is plastered to his skull and parted in the middle. He wears rimless glasses. The walls are covered with invoices and corny leg art cheesecake pics that make Bill think of the trucking company Richie Blankmore's dad worked for. He went there a few times with Richie, and the dispatch office looked like this. According to the calendar on one wall, it is March of 1911, which makes no more sense than 1956. To Bill's right as he enters, there's a door. To his left is another. There are no windows, but a glass tube comes out of the ceiling and dangles over a Dan Duck's laundry basket. The basket is filled with a heap of yellow sheets that look like more invoices, or maybe they're memos. Files are piled 2 feet high on the chair in front of the desk. Bill Anderson, isn't it? The man goes behind the desk and sits down. There is no offer to shake hands. Andrews? Right. And I'm Harris. Here you are again, Andrews. Given all Bill's research on dying, this comment actually makes sense, and it's a relief, as long as he doesn't have to come back as a dung beetle or something. So, it's reincarnation. Is that the deal? Isaac Harris sighs. You always ask the same thing, and I always give the same answer. Not really. I'm dead, aren't I? Do you feel dead? No, but I saw the white light. Oh, yes, the famous white light. There you were, and here you are. Wait a minute. Just hold the phone. Harris breezes through the papers on his desk, doesn't find what he wants, and starts opening drawers. From one of them, he takes a few more folders and selects one. He opens it, flips a page or two, and nods.
Just refreshing myself a bit.
Investment banker, aren't you?
Yes.
Wife and three kids, two sons, one daughter?
Correct.
Apologies. I have a couple of hundred pilgrims, and it's hard to keep them straight. I keep meaning to put these folders in some sort of order, but that's really a secretarial job, and since they've never provided me with one...
Who's they?
No idea. All communications come via the tube.
He taps it. The tube sways, then stills.
Runs on compressed air. Latest thing.
Bill picks up the folders on the client's chair and looks at the man behind the desk, eyebrows raised.
Just put them on the floor, Harris says. That'll do for now. One of these days I really am going to get organized. If there are days, probably are. Nights, too, but who can say for sure? No windows in here, as you will have noticed. Also, no clocks.
Bill sits down. Why call me a pilgrim if it's not reincarnation? Harris leans back and laces his hands behind his neck. He looks up at the pneumatic tube, which probably was the latest thing at some time or another, say around 1911, although Bill supposes such things might still have been around in 1956. Harris shakes his head and chuckles, although not in an amused way.
If you only knew how wearisome you guys become. According to the file, this is our 15th visit.
I've never been here in my life, Bill says. He considers this. Except it's not my life, is it? It's my afterlife.
Actually, it's mine. You're the pilgrim, not me. You and the other bozos who parade in and out of here, you'll use one of the doors and go. I stay. There's no bathroom here because I no longer have to perform toilet functions. There's no bedroom because I no longer have to sleep. All I do is sit around and visit with you, traveling bozos. You come in, you ask the same questions, and I give the same answers. That's my afterlife. Sound exciting?
Bill, who has encountered all the theological ins and outs during his final research project, decides he had the right idea while he was still in the hall. You're talking about purgatory.
No doubt. The only question I have is how long I'll be staying. I'd like to tell you I'll eventually go mad if I can't move on, but I don't think I can do that any more than I can take a shit or a nap. I know my name means nothing to you, but we've discussed this before. Not every time you show up, but on several occasions.
He waves an arm with enough force to cause some of the invoices tacked on the wall to flutter. This is, or was, I'm not sure which is actually correct, my earthly office. In 1911? Just so. I'd ask if you know what a shirt waist is, Bill, but since I know you don't, I'll tell you. A woman's blouse. At the turn of the century, I and my partner, Max Blank, owned a business called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Profitable business, but the women who worked there were a large pain in the keister. Always sneaking out to smoke and, this was worse, stealing stuff, which they would put in their purses or tuck up under their skirts. So, we locked the doors to keep them in during their shifts and searched them on their way out. Long story short, the damn place caught fire one day. Max and I escaped by going up to the roof and down the fire escape. Many of the women were not so lucky. Although, let's be honest and admit there's lots of blame to go around. Smoking in the factory was strictly verboten, but plenty of them did it anyway. And it was a cigarette that started the blaze. Fire Marshal said so. Max and I were tried for manslaughter and acquitted. Bill recalls the fire extinguisher in the hall with "Better late than never" printed above it. He thinks you were found guilty in the retrial, Mr. Harris, or you wouldn't be here. How many women died? 146, Harris says. And I regret every one, Mr. Anderson. Bill doesn't bother correcting him on the name. 20 minutes ago, he was dying in his bed. Now he is fascinated by this old story, which he has never heard before, that he remembers anyway. Not long after Max and I got down the fire escape, the women crammed onto it. The damn thing couldn't take the weight. It collapsed and spilled 2 dozen of them 100 feet to the cobblestones. They all died. 40 more jumped from the 9th and 10th floor windows. Some were on fire. They all died, too. The fire brigade got there with life nets, but the women tore right through them and exploded on the pavement like bags filled with blood. Terrible sight, Mr. Anderson, terrible. Others jumped down the elevator shafts, but most just burned. Like 9/11 with fewer casualties. So you always say. And you're here. Yes, indeedy. I sometimes wonder how many men are sitting in offices just like this. Women, too. I'm sure there are women. I've always been forward-looking and see no reason why women can't fill low-level executive positions, and admirably. All of us answering the same questions and sending on the same pilgrims. You'd think that the load would lighten a little each time one of you decides to use the right-hand door instead of that one. He points to the left. But no. No! A fresh canister comes down the tube. Zoop! And I get a new bozo to replace the old one, sometimes two. He leans forward and speaks with great emphasis. This is a shitty job, Mr. Anderson. It's Andrews, Bill says. And look, I'm sorry you feel that way, but Jesus, take a little responsibility for your actions, man. 146 women, and you did lock the doors. Harris hammers his desk. They were stealing us blind! He picks up the folder and shakes it at Bill. You should talk. Ha! Pot calling the kettle black. Goldman Sachs? Securities fraud? Profits in the billions. Taxes in the millions. The low millions. Does the phrase housing bubble ring a bell? How many clients' trust did you abuse? How many people lost their life savings thanks to your greed and short-sightedness. Bill knows what Harris is talking about, but all that chicanery, well, most of it, went on far above his pay grade. He was as surprised as anyone when the excrement hit the cooling device. He's tempted to say there's a big difference between being beggared and burned alive, but why rub salt in the wound? Besides, it would probably sound self-righteous. "Let's drop it," he says. "If you have information I need, why not give it to me? Fill me in on the deal, and I'll get out of your hair." "I wasn't the one smoking," Harris says in a low and brooding tone. "I wasn't the one dropped the match." "Mr. Harris?" Bill can feel the walls closing in. "If I had to be here forever, I'd shoot myself," he thinks. Only if what Mr. Harris says is true, he wouldn't want to, any more than he'd want to go to the toilet.
"Okay. All right."
Harris makes a lip-flapping sound, not quite a raspberry. "The deal is this. Leave through the left door, and you get to live your life over again. A to Z, start to finish.
Take the right one, and you wink out. Poof. Candle in the wind type of thing."
At first, Bill says nothing to this. He's incapable of speech, and not sure he can trust his ears. It's too good to be true. His mind first turns to his brother Mike, and the accident that happened when Mike was 8. Next to the stupid shoplifting thing when Bill was 17, just a lark, but it could have put a hole in his college plans if his father hadn't stepped in and talked to the right person. The thing with Anne Marie in the fraternity house. That still haunts him at odd moments, even after all these years. And, of course, the big one. Harris is smiling, and the smile isn't a bit pleasant.
"I know what you're thinking, because I've heard it all from you before. About how you and your brother were playing flashlight tag when you were kids, and you slammed the bedroom door to keep him out, and accidentally cut off the tip of his pinky finger. The impulse shoplifting thing, the watch, and how your dad pulled strings to get you out of it."
"That's right. No record. Except with him. He never let me forget it."
"And then there's the girl in the frat house."
Harris lifts the file.
"Her name's in here somewhere, I imagine. I do my best to keep the files current when I can find them, but why don't you refresh me?"
"Anne Marie Winkler." Bill can feel his cheeks heating up. "It wasn't date rape, so don't get that idea. She put her legs around me when I got on top of her, and if that doesn't say consent, I don't know what does."
"Did she also put her legs around the two fellas who came next?"
"No," Bill is tempted to say. "But at least we didn't light her on fire." And still, he'd be squaring up a putt on the seventh green, or working in his wood shop, or talking to his daughter, now a college student herself, about her senior thesis, and he would wonder where Anne Marie is now, what she's doing, what she remembers about that night. Harris's smile widens to a locker room smirk. It may be a shitty job, but it's clear there are a few parts of it he enjoys.
"I can see that's a question you don't want to answer, so why don't we move along?"
"You're thinking of all the things you'll change during your next ride on the cosmic carousel. This time you won't slam the door on your kid brother's finger, or try to shoplift a watch at the Paramus Mall. It was the Mall of New Jersey. I'm sure it's in your file somewhere."
Harris gives Bill's folder a getaway fly flap and continues.
"Next time you'll decline to fuck your semi-comatose date as she lies on the sofa in the basement of your fraternity house. And big one, you'll actually make that appointment for the colonoscopy, instead of putting it off,
having now decided
correct me if I'm wrong,
that the indignity of having a camera shoved up your ass is marginally better than dying of colon cancer.
Bill says, several times I've come close to telling Lynn about that frat house thing. I've never had the courage.
But given the chance, you'd fix it.
Of course. Given the chance, wouldn't you unlock those factory doors?
Indeed, I would. But there are no second chances. Sorry to disappoint you.
He doesn't look sorry. Harris looks tired. Harris looks bored. Harris also looks meanly triumphant. He points to the door on Bill's left.
Use that one, as you have on every other occasion, and you begin all over again, as a 7-pound baby boy sliding from your mother's womb into the doctor's hands. You'll be wrapped in bunting and taken home to a farm in central Nebraska. When your father sells the farm in 1964, you'll move to New Jersey. There you will cut off the tip of your brother's little finger while playing flashlight tag. You'll go to the same high school, take the same courses, and make the same grades. You'll go to Boston College, and you'll commit the same act of semi-rape in the same fraternity house basement. You'll watch as the same two fraternity brothers then have sex with Anne-Marie Winkler, and although you'll think you should call a halt to what's going on, you'll never quite muster up the moral fortitude to do so. 3 years later, you'll meet Lynn DeSalvo, and 2 years after that, you'll be married. You'll follow the same career path, you'll have the same friends, you'll have the same disquiet about some of your firm's business practices, and you'll keep the same silence. The same doctor will urge you to get a colonoscopy when you turn 50, and you will promise, as you always do, that you'll take care of that little matter. You won't, and as a result, you will die of the same cancer.
Harris's smile as he drops the folder back on his cluttered desk is now so wide it almost touches the lobes of his ears.
Then you'll come here, and we'll have the same discussion. My advice would be to use the other door and have done with it. But of course, that is your decision.
Bill has listened to this sermonette with increasing dismay. I'll remember nothing? Nothing?
Not quite nothing, Harris says. You may have noticed some photos in the hall.
The company picnic.
Yes, every client who visits me sees pictures from the year of his or her birth and recognizes a few familiar faces amid all the strange ones. When you live your life again, Mr. Ander, presuming you decide to, you will have a sense of déjà vu when you first see those people, a sense that you have lived it all before, which, of course, you have. You will have a fleeting sense, almost a surety, that there is more, shall we say, depth to your life and to existence in general than you previously believed. But then it will pass.
If it's all the same, with no possibility of improvement, why are we even here? Harris makes a fist and knocks on the end of the pneumatic tube hanging over the laundry basket, making it swing.
Client wants to know why we're here! Wants to know what it's all about!
He waits. Nothing happens. He folds his hands on his desk.
When Job wanted to know that, Mr. Anders, God asked if Job was there when he, God, made the universe.
I guess you don't even rate that much of a reply. So let's consider the matter closed.
What do you want to do? Pick a door.
Bill is thinking about the cancer, the pain of the cancer. To go through all that again? Except he wouldn't remember he had gone through it already, there's that. Assuming Isaac Harris is telling the truth. No memories at all. No changes at all. Are you sure? How can you be?
Because it's always the same conversation, Mr. Anderson. Each time. And with all of you.
It's Andrews! He bellows it, surprising both of them. In a lower voice, he says, If I try, really try, I'm sure I can hold on to something. Even if it's only what happened to Mike's finger, and one change might be enough to, I don't know, to take Anne-Marie to a movie instead of to that fucking kegger. How about that? Harris says, There is a folk tale that before birth, every human soul knows all the secrets of life and death and the universe. But then, just before birth, an angel leans down, puts his finger to the new baby's lips, and whispers, Shh. Harris touches his philtrum. According to the story, this is the mark left by the angel's finger. Every human being has one. Have you ever seen an angel, Mr. Harris?
No, but I once saw a camel. It was in the Bronx Zoo. Choose a door.
As he considers, Bill remembers a story they had to read in junior high, The Lady or the Tiger. This decision is nowhere near as difficult. I must hold on to just one thing, he tells himself, as he opens the door that leads back into life. Just one thing. The white light of return envelops him. The doctor, who will bolt the Republican Party and vote for Adlai Stevenson in the fall, something his wife must never know, bends forward from the waist like a waiter presenting a tray and comes up holding a naked baby by the heels. He gives it a sharp smack and the squalling begins. You have a healthy baby boy, Mrs. Andrews, he says. Looks to be about 7 pounds. Congratulations. Mrs. Andrews takes the baby. She kisses his damp cheeks and brow. They will name him William, after her paternal grandfather. When the 21st century comes, he'll still be in his 40s. The idea is dizzying. In her arms, she holds not just a new life, but a universe of possibilities. Nothing, she thinks, could be more wonderful.
Thinking of Surendra Patel. Ralph Vijayananda, a close friend who also sold the rights to publish my books in lots of foreign countries, had a way of coming to me with interesting ideas at just the right time, which is to say, while I was between projects. I never talk much to people about what I'm working on, so we must have had some kind of special radar. He was the one who suggested I might like to try my hand at a serial novel, a la Charles Dickens, and that seed eventually blossomed into The Green Mile. Ralph called not long after I finished the first draft of Lisi's story, and while I was waiting for that book to settle a bit, translation, doing nothing. He said that Amazon was launching their second-generation Kindle, and the company was hoping that some hot-shit best-selling writer would help them out in the PR department by writing a story that used the Kindle as a plot element. Such longish works of fiction and nonfiction later became known as Kindle singles. I thanked Ralph, but said I had no interest for two reasons. The first is that I'd never been able to write stories on demand. The second is that I hadn't lent my name to any commercial enterprise since doing an American Express ad back in the day. And Jesus Christ, how bizarre was that? Wearing a tuxedo, I posed in a drafty castle with a stuffed raven on my arm. A friend told me I looked like a blackjack dealer with a bird fetish. Ralph, I said, I enjoy my Kindle, but I have absolutely no interest in shilling for Amazon. Yet the idea lingered, mostly because I've always been fascinated by new technologies, especially those having to do with reading and writing. One day, not long after Ralph's call, the idea for this story arrived while I was taking my morning walk. It was too cool to remain unwritten. I didn't tell Ralph, but when the story was done, I sent it to him and said Kindle was welcome to use it for their launch purposes if they liked. I even showed up at the event and read some of it. I took a certain amount of shit about that from portions of the literary community that saw it as selling out to the business side, but in the words of John Lee Hooker, that don't confront me none. As far as I was concerned, Amazon was just another market, and one of the few that would publish a story of this length. There was no advance, but there were, and still are, royalties on each sale, or download, if you prefer. I was happy to bank those checks. There's an old saying that the workman is worthy of his hire, and I think it's a true saying. I write for love, but love doesn't pay the bills. There was one special perk, though, a one-of-a-kind pink Kindle. Ralph got a kick out of that, and I'm glad. It was our last really cool deal because my friend died suddenly in his sleep 5 years ago. Boy, I miss him. The story is set in an era when such e-reading devices as the Kindle were still new. That seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? And bonus points for you Roland of Gilead fans who catch references to a certain dark tower.
Read by Holter Graham.
One, experimenting with new technology. When Wesley Smith's colleagues asked him, some with an eyebrow hoiked satirically, what he was doing with that gadget, they all called it a gadget, he told them he was experimenting with new technology. But that was not true. He bought the gadget, which was called a Kindle, out of spite. I wonder if the market analysts at Amazon even have that one on their product survey radar, he thought. He guessed not. This gave him some satisfaction, but not as much as he hoped to derive from Ellen Silverman's surprise when she saw him with his new purchase. That hadn't happened yet, but it would. It was a small campus, after all, and he'd only been in possession of his new toy. He called it his new toy, at least to begin with, for a week. Wesley was an instructor in the English department at Moore College in Moore, Kentucky. Like all instructors of English, he thought he had a novel in him somewhere and would write it someday. Moore College was the sort of institution that people call a good school. Wesley's friend in the English department, his only friend in the English department, once explained what that meant. His friend's name was Don Allman, and when he introduced himself, he liked to say, "One of the Allman brothers. I play a mean tuba." He did not actually play anything. A good school, he said, is one nobody has ever heard of outside a 30-mile radius. People call it a good school because nobody knows it's a bad school, and most people are optimists, although they may claim they are not. People who call themselves realists are often the biggest optimists of all. Does that make you a realist? Wesley once asked him. I think the world is mostly populated by shitheads, Don Allman responded. You figure it out. Moore wasn't a good school, but neither was it a bad school. On the great scale of academic excellence, its place resided just a little south of mediocre. Most of its 3,000 students paid their bills, and many of them got jobs after graduating, although few went on to obtain, or even try for, graduate degrees. There was a fair amount of drinking, and of course there were parties, but on the great scale of party schools, Moore's place resided just a little to the north of mediocre. It had produced politicians, but all of the small water variety, even when it came to graft and chicanery. In 1978, one Moore graduate was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, but he dropped dead of a heart attack after serving only 4 months. His replacement was a graduate of Baylor. The school's only marks of exceptionality had to do with its Division III football team and its Division III women's basketball team. The football team, the Moore Meerkats, was one of the worst in America, having won only 7 games in the last 10 years. There was constant talk of disbanding it. The current coach was a drug addict who liked to tell people that he had seen the wrestler 12 times and never failed to cry when Mickey Rourke told his estranged daughter that he was just a broken-down piece of meat. The women's basketball team, however, was exceptional in a good way, especially considering that most of the players were no more than 5'7" and were preparing for jobs as marketing managers, wholesale buyers, or, if they were lucky, personal assistants to men of power. The Lady Meerkats had won 8 conference titles in the last 10 years. The coach was Wesley's ex-girlfriend, ex as of 1 month previous. Ellen Silverman was the source of the spite that had moved Wesley to buy a Kindle from Amazon, Inc., the company that sold them. Well, Ellen and the Henderson kid in Wesley's Introduction to Modern American Fiction class. Don Allman also claimed the Moore faculty was mediocre. Not terrible, like the football team, that at least would have been interesting, but definitely mediocre. "What about us?" Wesley asked. They were in the office they shared. If a student came in for a conference, the instructor who had not been sought would leave. For most of the fall and spring semesters, this was not an issue, as students never came in for conferences until just before finals. Even then, only the veteran grade grubbers, the ones who'd been doing it since elementary school, turned up. Don Allman said he sometimes fantasized about a juicy co-ed wearing a t-shirt that said, "I will screw you for an A." But this never happened. "What about us? What about us? Look at us, bro." "I'm going to write a novel," Wesley replied, although even saying it depressed him. Almost everything depressed him since Ellen had walked out. When he wasn't depressed, he felt spiteful.
"Yes, and President Obama is going to tab me as the new poet laureate," Don Allman exclaimed.
Then he pointed at something on Wesley's cluttered desk. The Kindle was currently sitting on American Dreams, the textbook Wesley used in his Intro to American Lit class.
"How's that working out for you?"
"Fine," Wesley said.
"Will it ever replace the book?"
"Never," Wesley said. But he had already begun to wonder.
"I thought they only came in white," Don Allman said.
Wesley looked at Don as haughtily as he himself had been looked at in the department meeting where his Kindle had made its public debut. "Nothing only comes in white," he said. "This is America." Don Allman considered this, then said,
"I heard you and Ellen broke up."
Wesley sighed. Ellen had been his other friend, and one with benefits, until 4 weeks ago. She wasn't in the English department, of course, but the thought of going to bed with anyone in the English department, even Suzanne Montanari, who was vaguely presentable, made him shudder. Ellen was 5'2", eyes of blue, slim, with a mop of short, curly black hair that made her look distinctly elfin. She had a dynamite figure and kissed like a dervish. Wesley had never kissed a dervish, but he could imagine. Nor did her energy flag when they were in bed. Once, winded, he lay back and said, "I'll never equal you as a lover." "If you keep talking snooty like that, you won't be my lover for long. You're okay, Wes." But he guessed he wasn't. He guessed he was just sort of mediocre. It wasn't his less-than-athletic sexual ability that ended their relationship, however. It wasn't the fact that Ellen was a vegan with tofu hot dogs in her fridge. It wasn't the fact that she would sometimes lie in bed after lovemaking, talking about pick-and-rolls, give-and-goes, and the inability of Shauna Deason to learn something Ellen called the old garden gate. In fact, these monologues sometimes put Wesley into his deepest, sweetest, and most refreshing sleeps. He thought it was the monotony of her voice, so different from the shrieks, often profane, of encouragement she let out while they were making love, shrieks that were similar to the ones she uttered during games, running up and down the sidelines like a hare or a squirrel going up a tree, exhorting her girls to pass the ball and go to the hole and drive the paint. Sometimes in bed she was reduced to yelling, "Harder, harder, harder!" As, in the closing minutes of a game, she was often able to exhort no more than, "Bucket, bucket, bucket!" They were in some ways perfectly matched, at least for the short term. She was fiery iron, straight from the forge, and he, in his apartment filled with books, was the water in which she cooled her.